It is breaking news. Russia has finally responded to all the attacks on its civilians. These are some of the images, some of the stories that you need to know about today. Well, it's finally happened, and it has been a devastating attack. Missiles and more missiles, hypersonics and drones. We're going to show it all to you right here. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we want to thank you so much for being there and following us along. I know millions of people have been following this story now for several weeks, if not the last month, and we've been talking about the fact that Russia, Moscow, has been hit with targeting of its civilians. We have seen apartment buildings hit. We have seen people killed. We have seen railroad stations hit. We have seen school buses hit. We have seen civilian buses hit. We have seen infrastructure having to do with energy hit, which is affecting Russians even to this day. And while all of this has been going on, there has been this constant question about, okay, what's going to happen? What is going to be Russia's response in all of this? And something has happened today which is extremely significant in both Odessa and Kiev. But there's something else I'm going to be telling you about, because this is not a coincidence what's happening there. I want to be able to set this up for you kind of in totality, which is why we're going to be doing this mostly on a map and showing you that while that is going on in Odessa and in Kiev, there's something going on here on the front line which is about to become a breakpoint in this war, a very important breakpoint in this war. And I'm going to be taking you through all of this in just a moment. But let me take you first to the breaking news, right? What's happening right now? Here's some of the images that we're getting right now from Kiev. Here they are. As you can see right here, these are devastating attacks that suddenly came in the middle of the night onto Kiev. You know, you can only hope that a lot of the people there in Kiev are okay. Russia's intent is not to kill civilians. There have been the death toll, we understand. It could change, but when last we checked, it was about 18 at this point. Russia says it is firing at strategic targets, targeting military, energy facilities, quasi-military targets, airports, and other areas. And we're going to be showing you specifically some of these targets as they were hit. But I should tell you probably what some of the places are that have been hit. It's Poltava, Cherkasy, Chernihiv, Kiev, Odessa, and Dnipropetrovsk. Those are the main cities that have been targeted, and of course, some of the areas around them as well. Now, what's important is this has been a full-out onslaught. It's not like some of the pinpoint firings and experimental uses of hypersonics for showing the power of them that have been used in the past. No, in this case, hypersonic weapons, hypersonic missiles, Zircoms, Iskanders have been used for a very specific purpose on very specific facilities and very specific buildings, which the Russians think are part of the operation of the war against its people. They've even used strategic bombers, and the strategic bombers have been firing that. You've seen that special whistle missile that Russia has. It's called the Winged X-101. That can then, it fires, but then it itself is like a plane, but it's a missile with wings, so it can actually be guided into any target. I mean, this is like some of the most sophisticated weaponry that Russia was hoping not to have to use, but it's using it, and it's using it right now on Ukraine, and the effect seems to be devastating on the Ukrainian politic and the Ukrainian military, because many of these facilities that you're looking at right here are the facilities that are used in its, for example, I think one of those that you're looking at there was a hotel, and it's a five-star hotel. But here's what's interesting about this. This is not a hotel where tourists stay. This is not a hotel where Ukrainian civilians can stay. This is a hotel that was inhabited by foreign mercenaries. In other words, soldiers, troops, or trainers, or people who guide the missiles from countries around the world, mostly Europe, who are in Ukraine, but they're fighting on behalf of Europe against Russia. And Russia has chosen these as apt targets as a result. You may see also a gas station that was hit in one of these. There was a subway station that looked like it was affected as well, that was used for transporting facilities in the area. So, yeah, there's the gas station, by the way. It has been truly an onslaught. It has been the worst attack on Kyiv since the war began. And again, keep in mind, Russia had not wanted to do this, to have a blanket missile attack on Kyiv, because it didn't see that as part of its plan. What Russia wanted to do was win the war on the front line. It feels that it has been forced to do this as a result of the last month or so's attacks on Russian civilians. Now, what's interesting is, as you watch these videos, is this is going to be blown up by Western media as vicious Russia with a vicious attack on Kyiv. But in actuality, this is a retaliatory strike. And anybody who's fair-minded and has been looking at this would tell you that it's a retaliatory strike, because I've seen it with my own two eyes. I've seen apartment buildings hit in Moscow. I've seen what happened in Lugansk. I went there. I saw it. I saw what happens when a college dormitory filled with girls is leveled to the ground and the girls die in their sleep when the dormitory falls on top of them and crushes them. These are not made-up stories. These are things that have actually happened just in recent weeks. And the Russian people were themselves getting frustrated and saying, when will we do something similar to the people who are doing this to us? Well, this may be it. This may be it. These images, these pictures that we're looking at right now could be the very end result of the retaliatory strike. When it actually and why or how it was affected, we have yet to learn this information, because much of this is still developing. Will there be a second night of it, maybe a third night of it? What has been accomplished? What exactly were the military objectives? All of these answers will come, hopefully, within the next two or three days, and we're going to be staying on top of this and following this for you. But I want to show you something else now, because I think this is really important. Gene, if we could, let's go to the map. So all of that that's happening over there in Kyiv and in Odessa is happening while something else very important and very dramatic is taking place on the actual front line. And don't think for one minute that these two things are not somehow related, because it would seem that the Russians want to soften the theater or weaken the theater, right? And the reason that they want or need to do that is because they feel like they're close to perhaps achieving their military objective. And what is the military objective for the Russians? Well, we've heard Mr. Putin say this twice last week, one in an interview with a reporter and another in a military briefing that he held. And it's this, right? These four oblasts that are so important that the Russians have been trying to capture. But the most important part has been the Donbas. So what is the Donbas? The Donbas is basically two oblasts. There's one called Luhansk, which is above the area we're looking at here. And this is Donetsk, right? So Donetsk is the area. Luhansk has already been, as the Russians call it, liberated. The people who live there are Russians, speak Russians, attend Russian churches, and they feel like they want to live their lives as Russians. They felt like they were being put upon by the Ukrainian military, and they told me when I asked them that what they wish to do is to live their lives as Russians. Fine. Russians are going to grant that wish that they have, and that's already been accomplished in Lugansk. But here in the rest of the Donbas, which is Donetsk, it hasn't happened yet. There's still about another 10 to 15% of Donetsk, which is not in Russian control. There's reason to believe that that's about to change. And there's reason to believe that that's about to change in the next coming days. So let me take you through it. Sources are now telling us that Russia, within the next few days, will liberate Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Druzhkovka, and even more importantly, Konstantinovka. These four cities, these are the four cities. Let me put my stuff down on the desk over here. These are the four cities that essentially remain in terms of Russia's ability to not just go beyond this area right here to gain control of Donetsk and essentially this area and those four cities, which are obviously important. But it's for this reason. The defense line of the Ukrainians is like right in here, right? So if and when they get these cities, as many believe is shortly about to happen, they then will be able to move all the way out to here because there's not much beyond that. That's why this move associated with the hitting of Kiev so that they can't then make decisions to support this because they're too busy protecting their own eggs over there is so important. You see what I mean? It's not a coincidence. This is not happening because all of a sudden we just said it seems, let me see how I can explain this to you, based on my interviews with sources here and everything that I've seen develop. It seems like the Russians were waiting for the right time to do what they did. And while everybody, including people I know here who I hang out with on weekends, are like telling me, this is crazy. Why doesn't our government respond? Why are they letting our buildings get hit? Why is Putin not responding? You know, people have been asking these questions, and they're fair questions. Mr. Putin is probably asking himself these questions in the middle of the night. They were waiting for the right moment to do it. And it appears at this point, and this is analysis on my part, to be fair. This is not a quote I've gotten from anybody in the government, but it would seem at this point that this is the moment they wanted to use to do it in. In other words, we're on the brink of doing what we have to do here. Let's relieve the pressure or create pressure over there so then we can move in and do this over here as we move forward. They could possibly be on the brink of liberating this area, which means they're done with the Donbass. They have control of the Donbass. And now, as Mr. Putin has intimated, they might be ready to sit down and do a deal to finally end this war. There's really no more land that they wanted. This was the goal. If they have achieved their goal, there's a possibility we may be looking at the beginning of the end or the end of the beginning or however you want to explain it. But, you know, it could be. It could be. I mean, this is analysis, but it's important analysis that we need to consider because for so many years now, we've been looking at this thing and hoping that this thing can finally come to an end. Roman Kasarov is our correspondent. He's been following this story. He's in Donetsk. He's actually following this story right now. He's been on top of this situation for a lot longer than I am, so he's a much more of an expert than I am. And he's good enough to join us now to give us some information on what's been happening throughout. And I guess the place to start is in Kiev, although other cities have been joined us. Roman, thank you so much. I know you've had a crazy busy day today, and it's going to be a longer one still. Thanks for joining us, dear colleague.
Thanks, Rick. It's good to be here and to have all the details that you might want, something that you've just talked about targets in Kiev. And I guess I have the particulars if you want to hear about them.
Yeah, let's start with Kiev. I think that's the most important part. Tell us, if you would, what was used, what was the objective, and what was hit?
Well, Russian defense ministry already said that they used high precision weapons, ground-based, sea-based, air-based. But I guess what's more important here and what you've just talked about are the targets that were used in this retaliation strike by the Russian defense ministry. Now, one of the targets was a radionics factory. Now, that is a key scientific and production base that makes control systems for long-range ground-based cruise missiles, such as the Flamingo, which Ukraine talks about so much recently, and as well as operational tactical missiles, such as Firepoint 7 and 9, something they talked about in Europe quite a lot and something that Ukraine continuously is begging money for. Now, also, they also produce guided missiles, such as the Neptune MD and anti-aircraft guided missiles. Now, all those products that are directly that directly impact the combat capabilities of the Ukrainian Air Force and, of course, its ability to counter air defense systems. Rick, if you bear with me for just a couple of minutes, there were so many targets to cover here, and they're all important, if you will, just
no,
to show the scale of this retaliation.
No, and we've got some pictures. And by the way, Roman, we have some pictures that we're going to be showing. So while you're talking, our crew will try and match the descriptions that you're giving of the video that we're just now getting in. This is still a developing story, folks. So Roman and I are kind of going through this as we get the information. Yeah, we're going to be sharing it with you.
Another target was a key radio electronics company called Athlon Aviation. Now, that company supplied Ukraine with various types of drones and loitering ammunition. Also, aviation industry assembly plants. Now, that's the main production base in Ukraine of manned military aircraft, as well as the assembly and modernization of long-range drones. Now, that was hit as well. Now, another target in Kyiv was a rocket assembly and component plant called Trimen Ukraine. Now, that one is tasked with modernization of all types of tanks and infantry fighting vehicles, as well as the production of optics for armored vehicles and components for almost absolutely all reconnaissance and strike drones as well. Now, their integrated circuits and microassembly elements for all defense systems, electronic warfare systems, and aviation equipment directly affect the combat capabilities of the Kyiv regime. And let's go a little bit further along the targets in Kyiv. A company called PV Group Ukraine. Now, their plant was struck as well. That company manufactures and stores the software and hardware components of the Lima electronic warfare system for spoofing navigation signals of the guiding systems of high-precision weapons. Rick, that's just a few of the targets that were struck by the Russian military overnight, as others included, like you said earlier, military airfields, logistics sensors that store drones, and as well as Western-supplied, NATO-supplied military equipment, as well as energy facilities, gas distribution stations in Kyiv and Kyiv regions. And you also mentioned gas stations that were all hit.
You know, it's funny. I'll ask you about a couple of these specific things, and you could just tell us what you know or what you don't know, and it's okay if you don't know about it, because I know this is still breaking. We had a video of this five-star hotel where apparently Western mercenaries were living. Can you confirm that?
Well, yes, I have read quite a lot about this on Thursday today, and a lot of people, a lot of Ukrainians themselves are saying that this particular hotel was used by NATO instructors, by NATO military personnel. It's a five-star hotel, so I'm not sure if regular mercenaries will be able to afford that, but what's what seemed certain to me was the fact that NATO officials, NATO military officials indeed used that hotel quite a lot, and they did something that I don't want to say on this broadcast, if you will. I don't think that's allowed, but many Ukrainians were not happy with the results of their stay in that particular hotel.
You mean they're angry at the fact that their hotel is being used by Europeans to wage a war against Russia? Is there an antagonist?
No, they were.
What are they angry about?
No, they were angry. They were angry about their behavior. They weren't acting like NATO officers or anything like that.
I see.
They were just acting like a bunch of spring break teenagers.
that own the place, so to speak. So let me ask you this, because I know we're going to be seeing in Western reports lies about this. And I guarantee you the New York Times or the Washington Post or BBC or the Guardian will file stories saying that the Russians had an onslaught and killed civilians and targeted civilian targets. Do you suspect, was there a bomb that went in maybe the wrong direction? Will we be reading anything that would suggest that there was something hit accidentally or otherwise that was not so much a quasi-military target or a pure military target?
Well, we've been talking about this for years, about Ukrainian missile defense systems and how they're using them and the quality of the weapons that they get supplied from NATO countries. Mm. And a lot of the times, Ukrainian missile defense simply fails and hits civilian targets within Ukraine. Of course, that's always blamed on Russian forces without any proof whatsoever. But Russian defense ministry said time and again that it targets exclusively military and military-related targets, and all the damages that were caused to civilians have resulted from the, well, poor work of Ukrainian missile defense that hits their own citizens as a result.
Have we seen any reaction yet from either Zelensky or members of his government or anybody in the West regarding this onslaught attack by Russia, an attack on Kiev like never has been seen before?
Well, regarding the attacks on Russia, I don't think anybody in the so-called civilized world have ever condemned anything that Ukrainian, the terrorist regime did here, including the situation in Starobelsk, where you visited, Rick. It's as if Russians are sort of, you know, second-rate citizens, if you will. So nothing that, no crimes committed by Ukraine are ever recognized by the so-called, you know, Western community, if you will. In terms of the latest retaliatory strikes by Russia in Kiev and the rest of Ukraine, well, mayor of Kiev, the former champion boxer Vitali Klitschko said it was the most massive strike, and Vladimir Zelensky echoed that as well. By the way, Zelensky was on his European trip, you know, begging for more cash for his regime. He was in Ireland, actually, when before these strikes happened. He actually announced that the strikes are about to take place overnight, and he warned that he cut his trip to Ireland short, and supposedly he returned to Ukraine, but, you know, we will see.
I want to get your take on my analysis. I'm going to walk over here to the map, and I know you can't see it, but I'm going to tell you what I'm showing our viewers. My thinking is, Roman, that this did not happen by accident last night, that it, in many ways, the Russians knew they were very close to a very dramatic point in the war here on the front lines, and they needed Zelensky and company to have their attention there so it wouldn't be here, so they can do what they need to do here. And by that, I mean the Russians. So as I'm showing this to my viewers right now, I'm showing them a part of Donetsk, and I'm showing the cities of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk and Druzhkovka and Kostyantynivka, which are the four cities that our sources tell us are very close to being, quote, liberated by the Russians. That would give the Russians pretty much control of Donetsk. Tell me if I'm right about this, which would mean the Russians would be very close to having achieved their original goals. And that is very much tied to the attacks that we saw last night. That's Rick Sanchez's analysis. How close am I to the truth?
You are quite close, Rick, but there are, you know, Donbass Republic is still not completely liberated. Right. And there are territories, like you said, about 10-15% that are still under occupation. But the cities of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, that's the next step. And let me tell you about this step that's taking place right now. Now, the chokehold if you will, around Ukrainian troops in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk continues to tighten as Russia is actually advancing relentlessly in all surrounding areas, like the city of Konstantinovka, for example, that you mentioned, is almost completely free of Ukrainian army. And the liberation of that will mark a major, major milestone in the liberation of the entire Donetsk Republic. So we're waiting for that. Now, currently, at this moment, assault units are completing the clearing of the city from scattered Ukrainian formations who cannot flee any longer because they were basically left by their command. And in the same areas, the settlement of Piskunovka was liberated today, this Thursday, as the Russian forces actually unfurled the national flag there, the national Russian flag. Now, in the nearby settlement, also in the same area, Krasny Liman, now assault units are all Also, completing the destruction of scattered Ukrainian formations and have begun to actually get rid of the mines in the area, the mines left by the Ukrainian military as they were retreating. And besides Donbas, Russia is also successfully creating a so-called buffer zone near the country's borders in the Kharkov region, as well as several settlements there used by Ukrainians to attack Russian civilians have also come under Moscow's control. So basically what we have now is Russia advancing on all fronts. But of course, it's very important. I would guess it's a psychological milestone as well once the Donetsk People's Republic is completely liberated.
Yeah, and those are the cities, Zhukovka, along with Konstantinovka, Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. Roman, you are so kind. I know, it's hot there, isn't it? You look like it's a hot day where you are. What's the temperature?
It's 40 Celsius, but thankfully I have the Kalmius River here in Donetsk. The ducks and the geese have it worse, I think.
You know, it's funny.
I'm in the shade.
I've got to say something to you that people are probably thinking at home. As we've been talking to you, we've seen people strolling along in bicycles, people walking by, people in shorts, like it's just another beautiful day in Donetsk. The area where you are, which has been, quote, liberated by the Russians, it's peaceful, right? Is it peaceful?
Rick, I lost you there for the last couple of seconds, but I know what you mean. I've been coming to Donetsk since 2014. I've been covering Ukrainian aggression against the Russians here from the very, very beginning. And one thing I've noticed here is that the people will always come out when there is sun. There's quite a lot of sunny days here. There are loads of kids. It's very family-oriented. The streets are so clean, it's unbelievable, despite the fact that there was shelling continuously. The local workers, they would come out, they would plant roses. Donetsk is known as a city of a million roses because despite all the hostilities, they've had roses every single year, every summer. And I fell in love with this region ever since I arrived here back in 2014. I've christened a couple of kids here, so I have a kind of spiritual family. And the resilience of these people is simply unmatched. They've been living under Ukrainian aggression since 2014. That's 12 years. The kids that you saw behind me, some of them weren't even born 12 years ago. Yeah. That means that they lived their entire existence through war, but nevertheless, they still smile and they still hope for peace, and they still hope that the life will return back to normalcy. But they create this normalcy by themselves, by walking around, by walking their dogs, walking with their kids. It's all about human nature. Mm-hmm. We'll survive no matter what.
Doesn't exactly look like a war zone, and sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words, indeed. Roman, you are such a trooper. Thank you so much for hanging in there. Great reporting throughout the day, bringing us the latest on this huge, huge development on this war. And we thank you once again for taking time to be with us.
Thanks, Rick.
Yeah, Roman really put the story into words. And what we want to do now is we want to break it down further. What I'd like to do now, moving away from the front and moving away from what actually happened there with direct reporting from somebody like Roman, is break down the geopolitical repercussions of this. Where do we go from here? So what happens next in the war? Are we close to a truce? Well, one of the world's foremost authorities on geopolitics and leading Russia expert, Professor Richard Sakwa, is going to be joining us to do this with us. When we come back, don't go away. It only gets better. And hello again, everybody. Welcome back. Boy, what a day. The breaking news is it's finally happened. You know, we have been wondering, I have been wondering, you have been wondering, and we've asked this question many times. How long can Russia continue to have its infrastructure attacked, its citizens killed, what are essentially terrorist attacks against Russia? It's been happening for the last 3 weeks in earnest. I mean, it's been happening all along, but it's really picked up since it seemed like the Europeans made a tactical or strategic decision to change what their strategy was in terms of the war, and rather just feeding Ukraine so Ukraine can fight Russia on the front lines, they decided to essentially start hitting Russia proper, like attacking apartment buildings in Moscow and attacking Russian energy infrastructure and attacking railroads and those types of things. And it's been happening, you know, successively for the last 2 or 3 weeks. I've covered it. I've showed it to you. I've been there. I've interviewed the people who were involved in some of the places where this has happened. So today, the story is that Russia has retaliated. Russia has apparently, you know, the bear was poked so many times, it finally woke up and decided to growl, and it is growling loudly in places like Kiev and places like Odessa right now. And there's also information that they may be able to have a big break on the front line in some of the key cities that I've been showing you on the map. So joining us now is Richard Sakwa. He is a professor emeritus of politics at University of Kent. And he's good enough to catch up this breaking news with us to help us analyze it. Professor, thank you so much for taking time to join us today.
My pleasure.
Would you take us through your initial reaction to this breaking story of what's happening today, both on the front line and more pointedly in the attacks on Kiev with hypersonics?
Well, as for the front line, I'm not entirely sure that there is going to be this breakthrough. Clearly, the pressure is continuing. Konstantinovka is more or less three-quarters surrounded. Mm-hmm. But it's still a ways to Slovyansk and Kramatorsk and the other towns. And given the enormous defensive power of drones and the coverage, and you can't get really any major accumulations of forces nowadays, up to 50 kilometers either side of the front line. So the nature of warfare has changed to allow the defenders an advantage. Well, we'll see what happens. And so clearly Russia is pushing forwards. But I thought the generals were arguing that with a bit of luck, by the end of the year or mid-autumn, will they be able to get Slavyansk, Kramatorsk and the other towns. But who knows? I mean, the Ukrainian forces are concentrating there. Meanwhile, Russia's pushing ahead, not just on that particular front, but also from the north in Sumy to have some sort of border zone, defensive zone, and also to a degree in the south, the Zaporozhye front. So the war is live all along. As for the Kiev attacks, you're right. I've just come back from Moscow. And we had fascinating discussions, and views are divided. On the one side, you have the hardliners who are saying that, indeed, what you've just said, that Russia has been fighting the war, not just with one hand tied behind the back. When I mentioned this, somebody said, no, what are you talking about? It's two hands tied behind the back. Why has Russia been so passive in responding to the attacks in Russia, as you said, and of course the awful incident in the Starobielsk, the school, which killed at least 18 girls and some boys as well, so 21 people in total, an absolutely awful incident, and it was a double tap attack, which makes it even worse. that when the rescuers get there, they then send in another wave of missiles and drones. So absolutely, that's on the one side. On the other side, you've got people saying, look, guys, don't respond to provocations. That's what Kiev wants. That's what the Westerners want. Mm. So what we could say is this attack on Kiev now is a sort of measured response, because there's a lot people pushing. And we saw just a few months ago the list of drone manufacturing sites within the European Union, in NATO land, let's call it that, NATO stan. You know, the fact that the list was published suggested that they could become the object of attack. But so in other words, this is a midway from a full scale saying, look, if you can attack our defense installations, we'll attack yours as well. So Russia's trying to keep the war to Ukraine.
And it would be safe to say, would it, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, that up to now, the Russians had been mindful of not allowing this to become a total war scenario where they're attacking buildings and going after civilians. In fact, every time I check, I see only 15,000 or so civilians have lost their lives in this war. Half of those probably maybe victims of the Ukrainians, half of them victims of the Russians. One, even just 15 people is too many, so I'm not saying that 15 is a small number. But when you compare it to the number of civilians killed in, let's say, Iraq, an act that NATO was involved in, an act my country, the United States, was involved in. When you compare it to what's happening now in Israel with their attacks, it's diminishably smaller. So Russia has not wanted to do the kind of thing we're seeing it do today, has it?
Absolutely. Right from the beginning, the intention has been to keep civilian losses to an absolute minimum, to attack just military objects, transport, energy, infrastructure, and other issues. So, indeed, some people have been arguing in Russia, of course, that Russia should go do a full Israel, as it were, the sort of mass murder in Gaza, South Lebanon, and elsewhere. But, of course, Russia's not doing that. They've been careful to, of course, their accidents happen. Of course they do.
Yeah.
And as you say, 15,000 civilian deaths is far too much. But the big picture, of course, is that this whole war is two great nations, the Ukrainians and the Russians, slogging it out in a First World War style. And of course, just in mid-June, we entered the... this war is now longer than the First World War. A few months ago, we made it the longer than Soviet participation in what they call the Great Fatherland War, or the Second World War. So this is just dragging on. But this is because military technology has changed. I mean, without drones, Russia would have a huge advantage with tanks, artillery, aircraft, everything, the whole shebang. And of course, but what you've said is the key point, is that Russia certainly has tried to avoid making this into a full-scale Russia-NATO-stand war, Russia-European war. It's becoming one. And both Washington and Moscow have tried, and they've got sort of red lines internally to prevent this escalating into a nuclear war. Of course, some commentators within Russia say that the whole power of deterrence, that nuclear weapons seem to have lost their... the West seems to have lost its fear of nuclear weapons. And therefore, a salutary... Well, how can I put it? It wouldn't be a shot across the bows, because a nuclear weapon is rather bigger than that, because it wouldn't be a shot across the bows. It would blow up the ship entirely. But in other words, to instill the fear of nuclear weapons in Russia, with at least 4,000 nuclear weapons ready to go, and the United States has got the same. And therefore, those who argue that we are now already in the Third World War, I think are mistaken. If we were in a Third World War, I think we would know it.
What would you think the Russians could use to show their dominion? Would they use a series of Arashnik strikes with something resembling or coming near nuclear, but not exactly nuclear? What would that look like?
Yeah, that's the other option, is to use these hypersonic weapons of one sort or another on perhaps a military target. There's one commentator has argued that a salutary use of a non-nuclear hypersonic weapon on NATO headquarters in Brussels would shock the Europeans, shock the Westerners to such a degree that they would then start a negotiation process. And of course, he's arguing, this person, is that they should be given a good warning to keep the civilian and deaths to a minimum, if not entirely, an hour's warning, say, go empty it out and then destroy it. That really would be a shock. However, I must say, as I say, I was in Moscow at various academic conferences in recent weeks, and I think the more rational voice is that, no, let's keep this war contained. We just keep pushing, we can keep going. And what was interesting, the point that you made earlier, is that Russia is indeed under attack. In fact, even the house I was in Moscow Oblast, I won't say where, the house I was in, the first night, there were two huge explosions at 10 past 7 in the morning, woke me up. And then at 12 past 7 in the morning, the whole house shook with an even bigger explosion. In other words, for me, this is Moscow Oblast. This is the region surrounding the city of Moscow. Mm-hmm. Not too far. I won't even give the distance. I don't want to give too much information. But just to say, it wasn't far from the city. And these huge explosions, and they were maybe parts of drones, or what the Russians call POV, the anti-aircraft, anti-Sasha. In other words, the war's there. Looking out of my hotel window, I saw huge queues for petrol stations. Now, and there were police there and so on. That may not reflect shortages as much as panic buying, but definitely. In other words, the feeling is, don't rise to provocations, keep calm, carry on. And you yourself said, and the excellent reporter from Roman from the Donbass, that Russia is pushing forwards in purely military terms. But there's another key point in all of this. The fact is that we are now in the fifth year of this war, and there is no negotiation process. The best hope, of course, has been the Donald Trump, the Alaska process, Kushner and Witkoff. There's talk of them coming to Moscow again. Putin has always welcomed them and spent many hours talking with them. Absolutely pointless, because they're not diplomats. They don't know. They've got no backup. I mean, it should be the State Department. It should be the National Security Council. It should be, you know, the professionals doing this, rather than these two, you know, they're amateurs, basically, however well-wishing, however useful any contact and dialogue is.
Do you think there's a possibility that they're going to pick up the talks again now? Will this strike on Kiev make the U.S. in particular more apt to want to talk?
No. Unfortunately, this is why we sometimes, and obviously we haven't got time to do it now, we have to go right back to say, look, what is, let's call it NATO Stan. What is this beast which has taken place, established after 1945? It's simply, and then of course after 1989, the end of the First Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, the evidence is there. It is unable to engage in diplomacy. It's unable to see the position of the other. And this doesn't just apply to Russia. It applies to China to a lesser degree. It's less sharp at the moment. But, for example, Chinese concerns over Taiwan are often just brusquely dismissed, though at the margins respected. And the same thing about Russia's larger views over the... I mean, because this war has been brewing for 30 years.
Yeah.
It's been brewing all sorts of things. And yet... you know, by the second year of the First World War, I mean, in the third year, some negotiations began. I mean, no back channel stuff. There's nothing at the moment, nothing substantial. That is one of the most astonishing things. And ultimately, we could ask, you know, we can answer it as well. You know, what is this war about? And what does Europe want out of it? What does Russia want out of it? We know that. What does the United States want out of it? Is it Russia's strategic?
Let me offer something. The reason it's not over is not because Ukraine doesn't want it to be over, and it's not because Russia doesn't want to be over. It's because Europe doesn't want it to be over. That's why it's not over. Am I wrong?
That's right. No, this was quite clear at the G7 summit at Evian-les-Bains in France just a couple of weeks ago. The argument was is that the Iran war is over, and now, Trump, you've had your fun over in with your third Gulf War. Now concentrate on a big one, and let's really up the ante, put the pressure on Russia, restore the sanctions, which of course Trump has done on oil and all the rest, and more weapons, more push, more sanctions, more war, until, well, then the question, as I say to my European friends, well, what's your end game? You know, what's the thing here? Russia's defeat? Well, you can't defeat a nuclear power. I mean, it's basically never been tried, and hopefully it won't. I mean, it's being tried at the moment. But as long as the war's contained within Ukraine, to the enormous suffering and detriment of the, you know, as I said, the great Ukrainian people.
Yes.
Of course.
They're great.
The, many
yes.
of them.
They're good
and
people.
Indeed,
and they have nothing. They're being used.
It genuinely is a, you know, two great Slavic peoples. You know, they're not the same. But with overlapping concerns, they watch the same films, they share the same culture, they go to similar churches, they worship in the same way.
Yeah.
Mostly, many speak the same language. And yet this is a war which has been fostered and, you know, poisoning relations between the two for 30 years. But, you know, if your next question is going to be, how do we get out of it? Well, we have to start more dialogue. By the way, another thing which I discovered, well, we all know about it, in Moscow, is that there are back-channel discussions. There is some dialogue going on.
Oh, that's good to know. You know, a lot of Russians would say the way we end this war is we just stay the course. And staying the course is the same thing we did with the Nazis and the same thing we did with the Poles and the same thing we did, I guess, with the Swedes. I don't know. You know probably Russian history better than I do. But
and the Mongols.
Yeah, exactly.
And the Teutons.
We got to stay and fight and win on the front line. We defeat their army and we walk away. That's the Russian way of winning wars. And that's, I imagine, what they say they want to do, right? If you sat down with exactly. Putin and said, what is your plan, sir? As Trump likes to say, sir. Well, that's probably the answer he would give you, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And as you were pointing out earlier, the immediate goal is to take over all of the Donbass. So there's about 15% left, as you showed on your map. And once that's over, and Putin has signaled earlier that, you know, compromise, that the line would stay where it is at Zaporozhye and Dnipropetrovsk and Kherson oblasts. And, you know, at the margins, maybe some discussion. But a ceasefire will just be an armistice. This is why, yes, Russia could do that, but it has to be some sort of formula which allows a Ukraine to emerge with dignity,
yes.
with a sense of selfhood. And, of course, Europe will have to accept it. The United States would have to guarantee it. China may actually help, and others, economic, and India, economic reconstruction. But there's no point stopping the war just for it to start again in a year's time, in a far worse, you know, way. Because Russia needs its security. Ukraine needs its security. Europe needs its security. The only one who's really not being damaged is the United States, of course, which... as usual, walks away with these things, even stronger, possibly. Russia weakened. You know, it's surviving, but clearly it's weakened technologically, import. But, you know, it's doing okay. But the economy is much weakened.
You're in the UK, so I imagine you've seen this for yourself. I've just been peeking at the head. I've been going crazy today covering news, and it's been hard. It's been a difficult day from a journalistic standpoint, checking with sources and trying to figure out what actually is going on in a story that's changing every 5 minutes. But I did get a chance to check CNN and the BBC, and I think I looked at The Guardian and a couple of other places, and they seem to me to be salivating over this thing. They are just putting big, bold headlines, Russia attacks the poor, innocent people of Kiev. And you know, war is hard, and it would be fair to say that Russia is punishing Kiev. I think that's fair because those things happen in war. But my point here is I missed those headlines when it was the other way around and Russian apartment buildings were being hit and when a school was hit. You know, it's almost like, you know, you're salivating and you're putting big, bold headlines now, but where the hell were those big, bold headlines when it was the other way? And that's a big problem here with the West. It's that, you know, they're not negotiating in good faith. They're essentially leaving a big part of the story out. Do you agree?
No, it's absolutely. I was monitoring quite closely after the awful Starobielsk incident, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago, that dormitory in Donetsk. Or in the Donbass. In fact, it wasn't mentioned. It was completely no sense of just how awful it was. Also, by the way, when the girls' school was attacked in the first days of the Third Gulf War, there was hardly any mention and no follow-up. The fact that there were four attacks on the same school. So once the parents arrived, yet more missiles slammed into it. And the monstrous nature of this. And, of course, at the same time, we have mass murder killing going on in Gaza. I mean, the the population is suffering monstrously. The destruction of whole apartment blocks in South Lebanon to maybe to get an AI-generated possible suspect. So they killed 30, 40, 100 people. And the West seems to, you know, European Union has done almost nothing, and yet we're into the 21st package of sanctions on Russia. And, you know, I just, you know, there's a larger issue, which while we're talking, hopefully people in the West will see this. As I say, I've just come back from not just Moscow, but elsewhere. And the astonishing thing is, first, that the Russian people, as you said, like the Donbass people, are remarkably resilient. These things going on, yet, you know, very calm going on. And as you say, there's no war fever in Russia. I mean, there's maybe some hotheads at the top, but basically they're saying it's a grim task and we'll see this to the end, as to repeat the point you've just made, that you know, we're going to stick it out to the end, and it's no sense of panic. There's no sense of, you know, fear and so on. But at the same time, there's a growing anger over because of what you say, that this is now turning into a Russo-European war. The elite, by the way, still has this little hope that Trump may come up with the goods. Well, if your last best hope is Donald J. Trump, then you know you're in trouble.
Well, you know, I'm starting to develop a little bit of... I talk to Tucker a lot. He's a good friend. And I get a sense... He's told me a lot of good things about Vance. I've never met Vance personally. I've never interviewed him. But I'm hearing some good things. I think if there's hope, it rests with Vance more than it rests with Trump. And certainly not with the other guy who I grew up with in Miami, Marco Rubio, but only time will tell. Professor Richard Sakwa, you are a delight to talk to, sir. Thank you so much for being so gracious with your time and sharing your wisdom with us. We certainly appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And that's the segment for now. Wow. On a break, on a news with so much, on a day with so much news breaking, it has been an honor to be able to follow it for you and share it with you as best we can. Look, a lot of this stuff changes, and what we think we know today could change tomorrow. Death tolls, attacks, mission statements, objectives, all the things that we've been trying to break down for you as best we can, that we're going to continue to break down for you as we go. Meanwhile, just a reminder that everything we do here, you will be able to see much of it on Spotify, on X, on YouTube. Unfortunately, in a lot of those places, they have a bias. So social media, do you know their platforms? They answer mostly to advertisers and to processors who decide what you're allowed to hear, what you're allowed to see, what you're allowed to say. And that's not terrible. I mean, that's not nice. It's terrible. But it's what they do. YouTube, by the way, is the worst. They canceled me and my 120,000 followers recently. So I've moved over now, and I'm warehousing my stuff and publishing my stuff on BitChute. And they're different, right? There it is. That's my webpage on BitChute. Check it out. We've started putting everything there. That's why I believe in BitChute, because I've talked to the founders, and they promised me that they are indeed interested more in you than in their advertisers and in their algorithms. So there you go, BitChute, right? No one is removed. No content disappears. Check it out. I'm going to be doing something there in about a half hour, 7 p.m. Moscow time, 1 p.m. Miami time. I do my live stream there where I interview people from around the world. Thank you so much for being with us. By the way, I think it's important on days like this to let you know that we do everything we can to try and bring you the very latest information as we get it, including the people who we talk to. Talking to a professor in the UK to get his perspective on things, as he's living in a system where if they hear him saying some of the things he's saying, they could put him in jail, because they're doing this right now. There was somebody who was put in jail from the West, from Pittsburgh, no less, who was visiting the UK just today, or pardon me, just the last couple of days. We're going to be checking in on that as well, by the way. So thanks so much for being with us. Thank you for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'll be looking for you again soon.